human contrast formed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so all to be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
When we're in the midst of grief, seeing the gift in what we've lost may seem far away, but on the other side of endings are new beginnings. Loss reminds us of the preciousness of life and can cleanse us through our mourning. Loss can be like the winter, which is always followed by spring. How can we move with grace through difficult losses? How can we reset our compass through the dark night of the soul? How can humor help us deal with everyday trials and tribulations, as well as triumph over tragedy? The answers to these and many other questions will be our focus today with our guest, Alan Klein. Alan Klein is the former director of Death Transitions in San Francisco. He's a recipient of a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor. He's the author of many books, including The Healing Power of Humor, The Courage to Laugh, Change Your Life, a Little Book of Big Ideas, and Learning to Laugh When You Feel Like Crying, Embracing Life After Loss. Join us for the next hour as we explore the gifts of loss with our guest, Alan Klein. I'm Jess Willis-Toms. Welcome to New Dimensions. Alan, welcome.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here. First of all, how did you find your way to therapeutic humor?
Well, it started over 30 years ago to what some people might say was a tragic event. My wife had a terminal illness, and she did pass away when she was 34. We found out when she was 31, and it was definitely a very... We had a young daughter. We had just moved to San Francisco from New York City. We always wanted to live there. She was born there. I was born on the East Coast. We found this great Victorian house that I always wanted. I would sit in New York City and draw pictures of Victorian houses, and I guess didn't realize I was manifesting a big Victorian house, but that happened. And then she went to the doctor, and the doctor said, we need to put you in the hospital and do some tests. Your liver doesn't look great. And they did the test, and he came back and said, I don't understand this, but you have a rare liver disease, primary biliary cirrhosis. He said mostly women over 65 get this, and Ellen was 31. Mm. So needless to say, it was a very difficult 3 years. There was no hospices at the time, and there were virtually no liver transplants. Mm-hmm. I think maybe there were five, and people just lasted a couple of months. So it was. But Ellen had a great sense of humor and continued to use it even during those difficult years. Give you one idea.
Oh, please tell me.
She was in the hospital, and she had a copy of Playgirl magazine with a male nude centerfold. And she said, Alan, hey, I really like this man this month. Can you put this hunky photo on the wall over here, the centerfold? And I said, Alan, this is a hospital. It's a little risque for that. And she said, well, maybe you're right. She said, why don't you get a leaf on the plant and cover up that part? And Justine, I did that, and things are fine for the first day, fine for the second day, but by the third day, the leaf starts shriveling up and reveal what we were trying to conceal. And we would just look at a leaf or a plant and or remember that incident, and we would start to laugh.
Oh, sweet.
And I realized it wasn't a lot of laughter. It was 5 or 10 seconds, but it helped us rise above the situation, gave us a little reprieve, gave us a different perspective, which humor always does in any situation. If you find humor in it, you see it a little differently, you get a perspective. I didn't realize it was doing all the time, but that's looking back. That's how humor kind of saved the day for us.
What was your work at that time?
At the time, I had my own business in San Francisco. It was a silkscreen company. It was doing very well. I had started it with a partner. And when Alan died, I went back and Tom, I said, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing in life. I said, I don't know what it is, but it's not silkscreening. You know, Ellen's death made me realize there was some bigger purpose.
But it wasn't only Ellen's death. You were left with a young daughter. I think your daughter, what, was 8 or 10
10 years old.
I mean, that's shocking. Now suddenly you're a single father.
Right, exactly. And so it was not an easy time, but there was some, you know, I believe in listening to your gut. Listen to my gut thinking, I'm not supposed to be doing silk screening. I'm supposed to be doing something greater, and I don't know what it is, but just give up the business. So I sold it to my partner, hung out for a while, and then this brochure came from the Holistic Life University. And one of the divisions was the Life Death Transition Institute.
You know, I have to say, Alan, New Dimensions was associated with Holistic Life University. This was way back when in the 70s.
Wow.
And they were on, what was the street they were
on? Kirkham, I think.
Yeah, Kirkham or Norton one of those is going. And William Staniger was part of it. Oh, yes. It takes me way back to our early days.
Yeah.
So you had a brochure and you looked
at... So I looked and I had a life death mission. No one that close to me had ever died before. I didn't want to do silk screen. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I thought, I'll take their classes and see what this is about. Hospices were just starting, so they were training people to work in hospices. We had a lot of nurses taking the course. And I just worked with them. I volunteered as one of the first hospice volunteers at San Francisco Hospice. I went back and got a home health care aide license because this somehow... Ellen's death triggered all of this, inquiry, like, what is death? Why do people die? You know, why did this happen to me? You know, so I was kind of that.
You mentioned in your book that a lot of times when someone is in the grieving process, it can be difficult to leap out new.
Mm-hmm.
So can you say something about that? You did the opposite.
Well...
That might not be typical.
Yeah, I don't know if it's typical, and I don't know that I can explain. All I knew that I got some message from somewhere saying that silkscreen's not what I'm supposed to be doing. Trust me, I will lead you. And I still believe when I do my keynote speeches, when I'm writing another book, I am guided to do this. And I, you know, what do you call it? Spirit, you know, I don't know what it is.
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery. And so for me...
It's a blessing, too.
It was a blessing.
Yeah.
And a mystery. And I felt real supported because by selling the business, I was able to then go work at Holistic Life for $5 an hour or whatever I was getting because they still had some other income coming in.
Yes.
So if I had to go and get like a real, I wouldn't be able to do that.
So that was a blessing.
It was a blessing, and I felt, and I also had a rental unit in my Victorian house. And so I looked at that and I thought, the world is supporting me in moving forward in a different direction.
Now, where did the humor come in? Because you're known as Mr.
Jollytologist.
I love it. And how? Where did the humor come in?
Well, a couple of things. One, looking back after Ellen died, I realized her sense of humor. We always laughed together. You know, we looked at other couples that are around us getting divorced, and we would ask each other, "Why are we still together?" And she would say, "Alan, because you make me laugh."
Oh.
And I didn't think I was that funny. I thought I was a pretty serious person, but I obviously made her laugh. And with her, I'd say, "Ellen, I'm still with you because life is an adventure that I never knew when I came home from work," because she was a gourmet cook, whether I'd have a great gourmet meal prepared just for me and her and our daughter, or there'd be 30 people that she invited for potluck and forgot to tell me. So life was always an adventure like that, which I, being kind of a reserved kind of person, I needed. I think I needed that adventure. We're kind of opposites, right. But what do they say? Opposites attract?
You had an experience at some point of giving a lecture someplace, and there was a woman who walked in.
Oh, wow.
And this was a kind of confirmation.
Wow. Do I have that in my book?
Yes, that is in your book. That story is in your book.
That was such a powerful story for me. And that is, I was doing a lecture at Holistic Life University. It was a 3-hour program because I was interested now in humor. You asked how I started. And then Norman Cousins was talking about healing himself with humor at that time. So I became fascinated with that subject. And so I put together a 3-hour program. And since I was the director, I was able to schedule it. You know, I just put myself in the slot.
You get to make it up.
I made it up. Exactly. And so I'm doing the program. It was one of my very first. Probably wasn't very good, but I look up during the first half, because we had a break in between. It was 3 hours. And there's a woman way in the corner that had kind of come in late, sat down, and looked exactly like my wife, Ellen. I was like in shock. I kept looking over there, she looked like a real person. I don't know. And I went on with the program because I couldn't stop. And I thought to myself, at the break, I'm going to go rush over to that woman and chat with her. This is unreal. And I started to move in that direction, pat me on the shoulder. And I turned around maybe for 30 seconds to answer that question, like, where is the restroom? Something real basic. I turned around, the woman was gone, and she never came back after the break. Now, Justine, I don't know if that was Ellen. I don't know if that was in my mind. I don't know. All I know is that what I took from it, that this was Ellen approving of what I was doing now, being there to kind of guide me. And I'll tell you the truth, even now, some 30 years after her death, I still feel every program I give, she is there. She is there in spirit. And so then, and then I start looking into that kind of thing, and I found this way to body right as it dies, and they weigh it before and right after, and right after, there's 21 grams less weight in that person. So what that leaves is, what is that? Why are we 21 grams lighter after the moment we die?
So you really have some confirmation in experience of some sort of energy that goes on after death.
Right, right.
Right. And in this form, it was Ellen really encouraging you to do the work today.
Exactly.
I'm here with Alan Klein, and he's the author of Learning to Laugh When You Feel Like Crying, Embracing Life After Loss. And if you'd like to be in touch with him and the work that he does, you may go to his website, alanklein.com. And Alan is spelled ALLEKLEIN.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. My name is Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. Here with Alan Klein, and he's the author of Learning to Laugh When You Feel Like Crying, Embracing Life After Loss. Alan, let's talk about the grieving process. You've mentioned in the earlier part of the interview your own process of having just a terrible loss in your life, and Losses. There's a lot of different kinds of losses. There's, as in your case, the loss of a dear loved one. Mm-hmm. But people can, you know, lose a pet, mm-hmm. and that can be devastating. We've mm-hmm. all known people who are very close to their animal companions, and mm-hmm. that's a big loss. Or these days, maybe loss of a job or a divorce. So talk about this. What can you tell us about grieving and how we can manage it or get through it or not get through it? What do you have to say?
First of all, I want to tell you that years ago, one of my very first published writing was in Prevention Magazine, and the article was called "Did You Die Today?" And it was all about all of the everyday losses that we go to: traffic jams, denting the car, you know, getting ill, not getting the raise, can't get in the restaurant we want. I mean, big ones, little ones, losing our wallet. You know, there's just all kinds of losses. And so it's not just the major losses of a loved one or a pet, but it's those everyday losses. And we kind of, on various stages, go through, I guess, what Kubler-Ross determined was the five stages of grief. I'm not sure I could even remember them.
Oh, I'm not sure that I can,
Depression,
too.
Anger.
Anger might have been one of the early ones.
Yeah, and I don't have any order.
And at some point, resignation, but yeah. I can't
until
remember the other two.
Until you get to the final stage. But, you know, everyone, because I was a hospice volunteer, and I'd see people grieving, and everyone in a different way.
An important point, isn't it?
I think it's very, because sometimes people try to compare my grief to your grief, and it's totally different, you know? And so you can't really compare. You just have to learn. And, you know, it's okay. The thing about grief, I think it's okay to cry, but it's also okay to laugh. And that's where I look at it, because a lot of people think they feel guilty. How could I laugh at a time like this?
You know, I want to tell a little bit of my own story. When I read that piece in your book, when you really wrote about that, I remember I lost my father and my little brother when I was 12 years old in a plane crash. And mm-hmm. they were like missing for 3 months before we knew whether or not they had survived it or not. We knew the plane went, they couldn't find it. And when we finally received the news that they did find it and they were gone, they were dead, my first impulse was to laugh. I remember laughing. It took me a long time to cry.
How old were you?
I was 12 years old, uh-huh. and I laughed. Uh-huh. And at the time, it felt like a really odd thing. I kind of cringed with people around me. They probably think I'm really a bad person.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was my first impulse, and you're saying it happened.
Coping. You know, that last year a book came out, The Other Side of Sadness, and it's by two researchers. Well, it's written by George Bonanno, I think is how he pronounces his name, but his fellow researcher was Dasher Keltner. And they did a 2-year study of people, and they talk about it in the book, The Other Side of Sadness, 2-year study of people who are grieving. And what they found is those who started to laugh or found some humor right after the death of their loved one did much better over a 2-year period than the people who did not find any humor. So here we think it's like not appropriate. How can you laugh at a time like that? And yet they're showing that it's so beneficial. I'm not saying that tears are not
right.
You know, grieving is very important.
Yes.
But also, I don't think we give enough credit to finding the humor. Because again, it's going to give us that perspective.
You tell a wonderful story of a woman who had lost her husband in 9/11 in the crash of the buildings. And you describe how she was filling an in-person report. Do you recall this? And she said, and she was filling in details. And then she said, and by the way, he left the house this morning with the worst tie. Do you remember that?
I do.
And you know, can you describe the tie? To give the visual, because I just now read it.
Yeah.
It was green tie with pink flamingos and palm trees. and she started to laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
And you really described that as when she said something like what you had quoted her as saying in the article that you had read, that she said, well, it's all that my family and I have now.
Right, right.
Because we've lost everything.
Right, and you know, in my research, there's stories like that over and over again I get from people. And I experienced it myself when I was in, a number of years ago, the major hurricane in Kauai.
Aniki,
exactly. I was scheduled like a week and a half later in Kauai at a hospital. And I thought they're going to cancel. They said, no, we need it more than ever. And all of these stories that came up, I remember one where a woman said, you know, they're telling us, get out, go shelter, go get cover. And she said to her husband's like pulling her out of the house, and she's going, no, my laundry's still in the dry yet. I can't leave. How could I leave with wet clothes? And they just start laughing. I mean, the thing is, humor is all around us. But I think when we're dealing with loss and grief and we forget it, you know, but it is so beneficial.
I know for me, when I am feeling in or feeling something very strongly and someone just comes up to me in what I would say is prematurely and saying, oh, someday you'll look back on this and you'll feel much better. Or you know, all these cliches and words of comfort. When I'm not ready to receive them, I want to feel something else and I want to be acknowledged.
Right. Yes.
To feel,
yes.
To say, I am either angry or I am sad. I am depressed. I am feeling lonely. I feel lost. I feel grief. And I don't want to be moved off of that too soon.
Right. Well, my advice, you need to listen to the other person. You can't. If someone is ill in the hospital, you would like to cheer them up, but maybe they just heard some terrible diagnosis, right, came in. You can't go in with a joke. You go in and you chat with the person and you see how they're doing. And if laughter comes up, great. If tears come up, great. You know, I learned that as a hospice volunteer, that I couldn't go in and try to cheer things up. I just had to be there for whatever happened.
Sometimes do you feel, maybe this is getting a little psychological, do you feel like people who want to change the mood of another like that is their own inability to be in that space themselves?
Right. They may feel very uncomfortable with that space, so they cannot just go in and be with the person. You talk about what grief is. You know, this is part of it. How to deal with someone who is ill or dying. And my thing is, forget about the human. Just listen.
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 That's a big word, isn't it?
Yeah. This lesson, I may have it in my other, The Courage to Laugh. I think I do. But I was a new volunteer, San Francisco Hospice. And I was assigned one of my first patients, and I go in, and the woman's lying on the couch, and Dating Game is blasting away on the TV. And I thought, I'm a volunteer. I want to help this person, but I'm not helping. She's couching.
Watching TV.
I kind of lowered it, and she said, make that louder. And so I did, and then shouting, because over the TV, I said, I'm here to help you. Anything I can do. And she thought for a while and she said, do you know how to dance? So I got up and I danced around the room to Dating Game music and I sat down. I said, how do you like that? And she kind of shrugged her shoulders. I was becoming frustrated, so I kept asking her, is there anything I can do? Is there anything I can do? Long silence, and she said, you could leave. My heart sank. The family came back. I didn't tell them what happened. I went to the hospice office, told them the story, and they got hysterical. Because they said if there was a camera in the corner of the room watching you dance around the room, you know, interact, trying to please this woman, how funny that was. And I started to laugh. But the big lesson this woman, I mean, every person, every patient I work with gave me some. And this one was, you can't go in with your own agenda.
There you go.
Just listen to that other person, and they're the ones that are dying. You're not dying. They're the ones that are ill. What do they want?
So maybe if you had that to do all over again, how would you do it now? If you walked in the room, Dating Game song?
Well, I may talk to her about Dating Game. Oh, did you see that? Did you like, you know what, you know, kind of in.
Sit down with her and watching it with her.
Exactly. And then maybe saying, is it, you know, is there anything you need right now?
Yeah.
but yeah. not keep saying, no, yeah. I'm a volunteer, I want to help yeah, you.
I want to help you. I have a way to do it.
But right? thank you, whoever yeah. she was. I don't remember yeah. her name, but she gave me yeah. a great lesson.
That reminds me of another story that you have in the book, and it was from Leo. When a little boy, he describes a little boy, a neighbor had some deep loss, and the neighbor was crying, and the little boy into his lap. And I think the mother asked, or someone asked, well, what are you doing? And the little boy said, I'm helping him cry.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
that's kind yeah. of what you're thinking about,
exactly.
is that to help them do what they're doing.
Yes, and I have a story that goes with it from my own life, which I didn't put in the book, which I just remembered as we're talking. When Ellen was dying, I went to a therapist. And after the second or third session, he told me, well, Alan, life is difficult. I got up and I said, my wife is dying. I don't need you to tell me life is difficult. And I walked out and I got Shanti at the time. I got a volunteer from Shanti. It was an older woman who lost her husband. We sat and we cried together a lot and we laughed together a lot. Because that's the way, you know, that comforted me more than somebody telling me life is difficult.
Right.
Just being with another person who understood and listening to what I was going through was so helpful.
And then that reminds me that it's good to isolate, although it may be difficult, that we want to pull in and not get out in the world, but it's good not to isolate when we've experienced a large loss in
right.
our life.
Right, because that's... You know, we want to kind of crawl up and die in some ways, you know, and some people do that. And one of the sections in the book, I talk about people maybe who are grieving way too long, not that there's a limit, but, you know, for years might be way too long, that there's probably two lives lost, the person that died and the person living but is not getting on with their life.
Right, yes, and you make a good point of that, that if we need to... At some point, look at, are we, as you say, a double loss? Are we just...
Right, right. So we need to kind of embrace the loss. It's why
exactly.
the five stages I have in learning
right.
to laugh, first one is losing.
I'm here with Alan Klein, and he's the author of many books. One is The Courage to Laugh, and another one is Learning to Laugh When You Feel Like Crying, Embracing Life After Loss. My name is Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with New Dimensions, and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast site mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org.
I'm here with Alan Klein, and we're talking about the processing and loss that occurs in all of our lives. And if you'd like to be in touch with his work and know more about him, you can go to his website, Alan Klein. That's A-L-L-E-N Klein, K-L-E-I-N.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. And Alan, the book is divided into five different segments.
Right.
Can you say a little bit about each
segment?
Well,
you know, first of all, I thought if Kubler-Ross had five steps, mm-hmm. five stages, I want five stages. But mine all begin with L. So losing. And we just talked about that in the last segment, about kind of acknowledging.